Welcome to Book Treasure. I'm very delighted today to be here with Di Morrissey to talk about the new novel, Distant Journey. Welcome, Di.
Thank you, John.
Now, A Distant Journey opens up in America, heading into the suburb next to Palm Springs, as far as I can gather, the 1950s or the late 50s or the
late 50s, yeah. Early 60s. Yes.
And it's a woman who is running from a bad marriage, or I think sort of there's a hint of violence in that, and she's escaping and running off with her son into a new life. How did this idea just pop into your head as a beginning point?
No, actually, it's inspired by my late ex-mother-in-law, who I absolutely adored. And it was a really brave thing to do in the early 60s. And she was in, I don't know, Oregon or Pennsylvania or somewhere, and it was, you know, cold. And she had a very unhappy marriage, and with an 18-month-old son, Peter Morrissey, and no money, she drove across the country and started a new life in Palm Springs, sewing clothes for children. And so it's sort of family folklore, where she was just extraordinary. And I like to explore, a woman's journey, but also putting people in the situation of being a fish out of water and that kind of different culture, because I married an American. And even though we think we're very similar, those small things really become quite big. And I was just thinking, plus the effect of landscape on the psyche, what would be the furthest place someone from Palm Springs could end up? And I thought, a sheep station in remote Australia.
So we get to meet Babs. She does create a life for herself. And then a knock comes on the door, and it's her niece running away as well.
Yes, 15 years old, and she's run away from the stepmother she doesn't like, and so she ends up staying in with her aunt in Palm Springs and goes to college. And so Cindy, we think, is set on life's path, but as women have a way of doing, we fall in love with often the wrong people.
And so it's Cindy that is transported from Palm Springs all the way into the outback of Australia.
Yes. Well, she falls in love with an Australian that she meets on business and holidays in Palm Springs, and there's a whirlwind romance. And the next thing, impetuously, as in the 60s, remember, that she comes out and marries an Australian with no idea of where she's going. And she finds herself on a sheep station in the Riverina. And it's such a different culture, landscape, setting, but she's also just slowly learns she's married into a family with some awful secret.
And she, Palm Springs, of you, the way you describe it, is full of film stars and the famous and the rich and the glorious. To go from that.
Yes. Well, I mean, Palm Springs is an extraordinary place.
I've never been there.
Look, you do have to go, because it's quite amazing. It's just this jewel in the middle of the desert, with all of this money pumping water into these emerald lawns, and the lawn stops there and the desert starts right next to it. But it was because it was only 2 hours from Hollywood, and the movie stars were not allowed to travel more than 2 hours away to be on call. So this became, and the climate is wonderful. So they built all these edifices, these amazing homes, which are now preserved because of that period of the 1970s. It was an extraordinary architecture and stuff. And it's iconic. So I just thought that would be the biggest contrast I could possibly imagine, to go from all of this blitz and glamour and piano-shaped swimming pools that Frank Sinatra had, and end up, in a sort of an Australian sheep station where all the money goes into the property. It does not go on frivolous matters.
Yeah. We're celebrating a bit of an anniversary with you this year, with 25 years in publishing
yes,
your novels.
Yes. Where's it all gone?
It's an extraordinary. I'm very privileged, because I get to speak to you every year. We get to have a chat, and I get a little bit more of the story. This is the success story that you have in Australian publishing. is unmatched. I can't think of anyone who's had that consistency right
through. No, it's
through.
Been around as long as me.
Well, the people can be like there's people like Tom Keneally, but they're not as consistent. They're not as they're not on the bestseller lists year after year. This is something which is enviable. Like a lot of writers are sitting along going, "How does she do this? How can I emulate what Di does?" But you've been able to do it.
Yeah.
It looks from my perspective, because you come in here and you're so together and you present your book so well, that it's not a great deal of trouble for you. But there must be times when you're going, but I've got this great run. I can't let this drop.
Oh, starting every book is the same as I did with Heart of the Dreaming with the first book. I mean, it's terrifying, and you think, and the more I think, really, the more you have some success, you think, oh golly, how did I do that, and can I do it again?
Yeah.
And so each book starts, you know, in the same nervous wreck. But I've decided that I just have to do what I've always done, and that's write for myself, and not be aware of that huge audience that's out there, and you can't think about trying to please everybody. So you just have to be true to yourself. And really, in some ways, the story kind of writes itself, in that, you know, it's inspired by a particular landscape and a setting, and then the issues around that and the people around that by going and living in the place. It kind of, you know, it leads me on, you know, into the story. But it's also, I've tried to tell our stories. I mean, there's still foreign bits in my books that have a link in one way or another with Australia. But I came in to publishing through, I had been working on television, and I'd been living overseas, married to a diplomat, and lived in foreign countries. And then I came back and worked in television and went around Australia and really discovered my own country for the first time. And I realised that we should be telling our stories. And it was then James Fraser at Pan Macmillan that's what he was thinking, that, you know, we shouldn't be kowtowing to all the foreigners, and we should be really pushing Australian stories. And luck and timing in life is everything. Mm. And I had written a couple of pages of something, and someone showed it to him, a lady who became a very famous literary agent. And James said, "Oh, this is what I want. It's set in Longreach. It's about Australians." And then they said, "Oh, are you going to put any foreign bits?" And I went, "No, it's a story set in Longreach."
Mm.
So, and the timing was right. And Australian readers were ready to read our stories. The Vegemite on the Table you know, all of that. So it's now, it was a bit revolutionary at the time, and we didn't know if it would work or not, but it did. And now we have a whole sort of genre in many ways.
Well, my bookselling career is exactly on line with your writing career, because I remember when your books came out, there really wasn't much in the market, especially not getting the full spread in the magazines and the posters on the bus stops and the side of buses. They weren't publishing and promoting Australian writing as they do now. And they, in that period of consistent bestsellers coming out from Di Morrissey, it gave other publishers confidence to actually put their toe in the water and get this great Australian writing, and not just turgid, difficult literary ones that no one really read, but big epic stories about our land and about our places. I mean, I read a lot of people like Rachel Treasure and Linda Alexandra, even Bryce. These people are the writers who came in and were able to have this presence in the Australian market because of the successes of your early novels.
Yes, well, it was to, you know, Pam McMillan, to Ross Gibbon and James Fraser that they saw that. I mean, I think they also, James said also that I'd worked as a journalist, so I could probably string a few words together, and I'd worked in television.
Yeah.
So either way, they felt that I could cover a couple of bases. But then once it took off, and you know, the first book really did work, but I mean, there's still that ongoing building up and exposure.
Oh, I'm not saying it was easy.
Yeah,
that.
No. And also the getting over the perception. I wanted to fight the perception that I wrote romance novels, so I didn't want to have pretty ladies on horseback or things, and, you know, on the covers of my books, because they were different. And also winning over male readers has been a long, an ongoing battle. And I now have, you know, a legion of men who write to me. And I think one of the touching ones was when I wrote Monsoon, which was set partly in Vietnam, and it touched on the Battle of Long Tan. And now when I wrote that, see, I've followed my instinct as well, against the odds quite often. It was coming up for the 40th anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan, and no one had ever paid any attention to Long Tan. So when I went there, you know, the rubber plantation, there was no big memorial, it was just, you know, pretty. There was just a band of fellows that were looking after it. And I wrote about that. And then everybody wanted to go to Vietnam, and a lot of the vets wrote to me. That's been the biggest compliment, that Vietnam vets wrote to me and said, it's like you were with us, and I'm going back to face the ghosts now. And their wives understood why they had come back so changed. And so, I mean, that was really wonderful. I mean, I'm still out there to entertain, but I do try to, I suppose that's my journalistic background, I still like to weave in some of our history. And like A Distant Journey is also set against the Australia's biggest business, you know, corporate collapse, with the falling apart of the wool stockpile in 91. So, yeah, so I try to weave in all of these issues.
I have this idea in my head of a really burly trucker driving, you know, hours down a highway listening to Di Morrissey on the audiobook.
Oh, it's true. Do you know what? When I first started, I had a lady come up to me at a function and say, my husband loves your books. He takes them to work with him. And I said, oh, what's he do? And he's a long-distance truck driver. He drives across the Nullarbor. And it's a very straight road, so he sits your book up on the steering wheel and he drives all the way across the Nullarbor. So he didn't have audiobooks. Many years later, she did write, so you'll be pleased to know he's retired from the truck driving. Now he reads your books in the living room.
That's so much better. Can you imagine?
Can you see it? I love that.
I can see it. That's the way. It's a fear of it all.
So it's nice to have, you know, fellows come up and say, I never thought I'd read a girly book, but, you know, your books are for everybody, love.
So when you're reading non-fiction books about the era that you're writing in, do you ever give yourself time off? Because a year is not a very long time to write a book. And so, you know, you handed it in, you start researching and thinking about a new area. And so your reading is kind of part of the book process. Do you just ever just stop and just read for pleasure with outside of...
I always travel with a book. I mean, even if I'm going to go to the doctor's and I don't sit in the reading room and in the waiting room and read the old magazines, I always have a book in my handbag, whether it is a research book or one for pleasure. But the best time is like the Christmas break around the pool at the beach on holidays. I just went through this year the whole Neapolitan Elena Ferrante, the four, one after the other. I save them all up to read in one big hit. Love them. So
they're extraordinary books.
Yeah.
And what else do you read? Did you read other contemporary Australian writers?
I do. I've just finished The Dry. I thought Jane Harper's book was fabulous. So I read anything and everything, because I'm also running a newspaper now, so I have to review books.
I do review things.
But I actually have a girlfriend help me out with that. But I mean, that's another opportunity to dip into books I might not actually look at.
Are there any authors that you look at? I mean, you know, I can read authors and be jealous of how they do things, but are there any authors that you just, with something, if they publish something, you just say, oh, I have to go? An Australian author, you might just have to go and grab the latest book. Is there someone you've been following for years? Or?
Well, Tim, I think. Yes, I've watched Tim's career, and when I first met him, I just thought he was very special. And I've just finished his Island Home. I haven't read his autobiography, The Curtain, Boy Behind the Curtain, yet. But because, you know, my books are very much inspired by landscape and place, and Tim's got his place that he's just so made his own. Yeah. And it's just, you know, I just stop and he's one person that I stop and reread sentences because I go, that's just wonderful. Yes, yeah. I'm a big, big fan.
Yeah, I was very lucky to have a bit of a chat last month.
He's
lovely.
He was absolutely
amazing. Yeah. It's. I find at the moment, because there's a sort of a people's movement happening within fiction, with the rise of of what they call genre, but it's to me, it's in my old bookshop, I used to have a section called popular fiction. Because why is it popular? Because it sells well and it's a good story. And to my mind, that's what is going on. It's a reaction to this exclusivity of certain prizes and a certain section of the book industry that seems not to reward writers who are successful. It almost seems like it's not allowed.
You're channeling Bryce Courtney.
Yeah.
It was, yes, Bryce is big a hobby horse. Yes, I think there is. Well, there's always been this argument, and it only happens in Australia. Everyone else has got over it growing up. But there's this issue between popular and literary fiction that one is possibly considered better than the other, which is ridiculous. So, I mean, you know, books are like food. You know, there's long gourmet dinners and special food, and then there's fast food, and then there's food that's satisfying, it's healthy food. I mean, it's everything. And I think whatever stirs your emotions, makes you think, or like people finish reading one of my books, they have to go immediately to the place where it's set.
Yeah.
Broom owes me heaps.
Yeah, oh, they owe you a lot. Byron Bay.
You know, yeah, just one after the other. So I don't know. And I mean, yes, I mean, one of the most hurtful things I think that someone ever said about me was my books were, you know, like hairspray, just sprayed on paper. There it is. She's whipped it out. Churned is the word. Churned out another one. Whereas over the years, I've learned skills and a system. I have evolved a system and to enable me to do a book each year and repolish it and repolish it and redraft it to get it to the best stage that I am proud to let it go out there. And that I've evolved a system which Pam and Melon have been very supportive in, that I have one editor who only works with me all year.
Yeah.
So I write one chapter, she gets it. I'm starting the second chapter, she does edits the first chapter, it comes back to me. So we keep going through it, and then it goes through the copy editor. And so between the three of us, we, in 7 months, have redrafted and repolished that book five times at least.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a system that that I'm fortunate to have. I see a lot of other authors, you put blood, sweat and tears for sometimes years into a manuscript. And there's a potential there, but then the editor says, you know, in chapter three, if you'd only done this, you've got to rewrite the whole book.
Yeah.
You know, that's a different process. So that is, I think that I, my books are there to the best of my ability, but I'm able to do them, you know, each year because of this system.
Well, anyone who says you churn them out hasn't actually attempted to write a book themselves.
Yes.
That's the thing. So many people have opinions about writing. Until you face that empty page and until you've actually got a manuscript that actually works from beginning to end,
yes.
Don't talk about it.
Yes.
Just go
yeah.
away.
But so, also, the fact that people are moved to tears to write to an author. And I always say to people when I meet them, they go, "Oh, I've always wanted to maybe talk, you know, write to you and say how much I enjoy your books." I'm going, "Please write to an author and say how much you've enjoyed the book, because you're not on stage with applause. You just don't know.
Yeah, you don't. You're by yourself
a lot of the time. And for writers and for myself, it's like a disease. You absolutely can't imagine not doing it. And to be able to make your living doing what you love most is, you know, is really absolutely, you know, wonderful. So, and as you say, writing is, if you've tried to sit down and even just write a letter of family history or anything to express what you really feel and you want to say, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy at all.
And it's also very hard to write simply. That's where my journalism training, I think, was really one of the best things I could have had as a novelist.
Well, that's the thing, is that the opening of Distant Journey is necessarily lightly sketched, so you're drawn into the story. Yeah, it's very complicated what you're getting across. There's so many different things going on in that first bit, and you know, anyone starting out as a writer would have all those ideas and try to plonk them all down and just be all over itself. And it's very, I find that skill of writers, especially writers who have been doing it for a long time, to say so much for so little. I always takes my breath away when I see.
That's well, again, that's journalism. So that I learned that when I was actually quite a bad journalist when I look back on it, because I put in lots of description and who said what, and of course the editors, the sub editors, just cut it all out with a blue pencil and they just chopped the bottom off. It was too long. So you have to get your audience in the beginning, or it's, you turn the page, you know, I'm not interested in reading that.
Yeah.
So that's always very good grounding. They didn't have creative writing courses in my day when I started.
Well, so few of the authors that I meet have done them. That's the interesting thing, is that so many people doing these creative writing courses, and yet the authors who I get to meet in these conversations, so few of them have actually done it.
It is a calling, and it's a disease. Mm. And sometimes I worry, you know, I'm asked to teach people or give talks, and I actually don't know how I do what I do. And I really think we're all kind of given a gift, and my gift is storytelling. You know, some people can sing or paint, and I wish I could do those. So, and then, you know, it's a calling, and once you are on the journey, then you hone your skills and your abilities. But essentially, it's really got to be a very honest thing. You can't say, okay, I'm going to write a book like this and have a template. Doesn't work. It's just really got to come from your heart and guts and soul and all those other painful places when that's what it is.
Di, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you today. I enjoy it every year. We always cover something a little bit different.
Yes, yes, we do.
But I look forward to many years of Di Morrissey bestsellers coming out perfectly for Christmas. As the bookseller in me, I just love the fact that you come out.
It was an accident in book one, and then after that it became kind of a tradition.
Yeah,
so
it makes the bookseller's life very easy. So thank you very much for publishing for 25 years, and it's an amazing achievement.
Thank you, John, and congratulations with Booktopia. It's really just an absolutely wonderful, wonderful thing to see happen in Australia. You're a groundbreaker too.
Yay! Di's book, A Distant Journey, is available from booktopia.com.au right now, as are all of Di's books.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.